welcome to We Do, the officially unofficial podcast for Watchmen on HBO. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking about season one, episode five, titled A Little Fear of Lightning. It's understandable at this point why he might have a little fear of lightning. Although he didn't get to see, really, the lightning. I suppose the aftermath. There was a lot of news reporting. And there was no lightning in this scenario, was there?
No.
Something in the Zack Snyder film. Where there was a fair bit of lightning.
I'm going to say that the experience, the appearance of an extra dimensional squid probably heralded by some lightning.
Yeah? Yeah. I think so?
Yeah. Hmm. I mean, you don't have to convince me much to believe that fact.
What did you think of this episode on second viewing?
I thought it's a really good episode. Hmm. I thought it fleshed out one of the characters that kind of was already a standout in the Wade's Looking Glass character. And I thought that it... did a lot of like really advancing the plot and kind of like, you know, putting a lot of the cards that it's been holding too close to its vest on the table. And now we can get down to, you know, telling the final act of this story. What'd you think?
Yeah, this is my favorite episode so far of the series. I think it did a really great job, like you said, of blending all the three things that this show is trying to do. It's trying to tell a cohesive story, it's trying to get a little weird, and it's trying to do some deep characterization around a theme. And I think this episode is a prime example of that, just firing on all cylinders.
It's also really audacious because there's several points where it kind of just dares you, the viewer, to nitpick it or to find fault with its storytelling or to, you know, and I think there are definitely some weaknesses by either design or by the fact that this is a crazy convoluted story they're trying to tell in nine episodes. Mm-hmm. But like when I started thinking about like what I would do differently, the only thing I kept coming back to is Wade's behavior seems inexplicable, except when I was watching a multiple case and I was really thinking about his, like, I'm trying to take seriously, because sometimes you see a character like Wade struggle with some kind of psychological problem and, you know, it's not your psychological problem, so it seems silly. And, like, what's sillier than being afraid of extra-dimensional squids, and what's more pathetic than this guy living alone and earning a degree in extraterrestrial squid science in his fucking bunker?
Yeah.
But like he's terrified of this shit. And the idea that, you know, the Seven Cavalry might be up to something, is something that he would have to take action against. It's like he could not do it. I think that there may be the thing that would have really sold it to me is if one of those basketballs had just appeared in a portal in front of him, like he was content to wait. And it also would have been another little thing that the Seventh Cavalry did to kind of like lure him in like cheese. But it's pretty good if you just take in mind his fragile mental state and how hypervigilant and paranoid he is.
Yeah. And I mean, I'll give to you, it's a little dubious in areas, but I think like the way that they mix like the sexual part of it with the fear that he has of this traumatic event, they're tied together, right? And so when they become yet again tied together in his present with this woman who he meets at this group, and she's like coming on to him and like follow me and all this stuff, like you start to realize, okay, well, this is a man who's not thinking rationally,
right?
Like, none of the choices he's making are good, including the one to go into this warehouse, right?
And then the cherry on the top is that he's a mask. And we've seen like all like mini masks, they kind of have this macho ball, Angela including, ballsy kind of approach to justice. Like Angela has no problem breaking into facility without any kind of backup, being there. Like you know, look at how Pirate Jenny behaves. Look at how the Red Scare behaves. Like they're not people that wait for backup and do things appropriately at all. So like. Yeah, the more I thought about it, the more I'm like, you know, maybe they could have done a thing here or there to make it a little bit, you know, more inevitable, but it's already pretty goddamn inevitable.
The other thing I really like that this does is there's sort of a weird deconstruction of superheroes, much like, you know, the original Watchmen does in Looking Glass, because we think of superheroes as having special powers. And I think Wade's superpower in this episode is shown to be just a farce. Like, he thinks he understands what truth is. He thinks he can detect a lie, right? And by the end of the episode, that is shown to be totally false. Like, he's been living his entire life under a lie that he didn't see. So, like, it really shows you, like, the superhero is driven more by pathos than it is, like, some, like, especially a Batman type, you know, which I think it's fitting that Wade has this underground bunker, you know, with all his gear and contraptions in it. It makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. Indeed.
All right. Why don't we get into the recap of this episode?
I thought we could talk about the title a little bit because you mentioned Little Fear of Lightning. Did you do any digging of that?
I didn't, know.
So this is a quote from 2,000 Leagues Under the Sea by Jules Verne.
20,000?
Did I say 200,000?
You said 2,000.
2,000? I'm off by order of magnitude. 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea.
Yeah.
And it was, the quote is, "If there were no thunder, men would have little fear of lightning."
Huh.
And there's also a reference to 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea when Wade asks the lady who stumbles into the meeting late, "Are you a friend of Nemo?" Which is, you know, obviously Captain Nemo had the Titanic battle with the squid, at least in the Disney adaptation. I think that's also in the book as well. And it's also mirrors Alcoholics Anonymous, I guess. Like, "Are you a friend of Bill?" is a kind of like a covert, you know, greeting for like a fellow alcoholic. And Friends of Nemo apparently are the way that you establish in a low-key way whether if someone else is suffering from extra-dimensional anxiety syndrome. So there's a lot of cleverness. Now, I'm not sure, like, if there are no thunder, men would have little fear of lightning. I'm not sure exactly what that means. I guess it means, like lightning itself is actually beautiful, and then you hit, and then you hear the, like, the clap of thunder, which makes it seem dangerous. And, but I'm not, I'm trying to think of, like, what, like what the psychic squid, it had it not, like, had the psychic detonation that killed a bunch of people. Like, what's the lightning and thunder here? But it might just also be a pretty subtle nod to the whole Nemo thing that they're doing here, too.
Gotcha.
Some housekeeping for this week. Over at swizzbold.com, Cecily and I are debuting One Weird Trick. It's Cecily and I's new lifestyle and advice podcast. We do a bit of an intro, then give some advice on dealing with nosy coworkers and losing your religion. On Pickle Me This, are you a private pooper? If so, this week's episode of Rick and Morty is for you. Check us out at Pickle Me This. On Bald Move Television, Alexis and Cecily are covering His Dark Materials, aka that one HBO show where the creepy menacing chick just can't stop spanking her monkey. Also, Jim and I talked to Mandalorian last week. Check it out. Bald Movies, really busy time. Last week, we talked about Ford Ferrari, a very masculine, macho show. This week, we'll be talking about A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood. Can Aaron make it through without sobbing like Donald Glover being sung the Reading Rainbow theme by LeVar Burton? Find out on the Bald Movies feed. This week's episode of Mr. Robot dropped a bombshell on the origins of the robot himself. If you're still reeling from the aftermath, come discuss it with us on 2-Bit Encryption. If any of these podcasts sound interesting, just go to baldmove.com and check them out, or search for the show name wherever you listen to your podcasts.
All right, let's get into the recap. We have a flashback for the first scene. We go to Hoboken, New Jersey, 1985. Wade's a Jehovah's Witness, which was interesting to me.
Yeah.
He tries to engage in some street, tries to engage and proselytize to some street punks who threaten him. This one of the girls takes his hand and leads him into the fun house. She pretends like she's going to fuck him, but instead she strips him and steals his clothes. And suddenly, out of nowhere, a psychic attack knocks him out. And when he wakes up, he walks out of the fun house to witness the carnage, which is spread across the entire city. It includes a giant squid that landed on several buildings. This might come out of nowhere, sort of, for you if you're not a comic book reader, but this is kind of the main event in the comics.
We've tried to prepare our listeners for the reality of the psychic squid.
Yes.
And here it is.
And it was more glorious than I could have imagined.
It really, like, because I always thought it looked silly in the comic book, because the comic book is a very, done very classic style, very minimalist coloring and shading. But this looked, I thought, real good. Like, this squid landing combined with it, like, psychically killing half the population of New York City and traumatizing countless more, and just its visual appearance and just how fucking shocking that would be, you know, seen in the flesh, so to speak. I thought was, first of all, it was funny because I was expecting, like, when they kept on panning out, I'm like, oh my God, they're going to show the squid. They're going to fucking show the squid. And they did it. And yeah, I thought it did real well. And it kind of, I remember seeing a lot of stuff that Snyder had said about the movie, about how like changing this to Dr. Manhattan made a lot of sense, and how you just couldn't, like, if you just did this on film, it would be silly. And I think he's probably right, but also they did it here and it didn't feel silly at all.
Yeah, and I think he was speaking from a time when, you know, the CG wasn't quite what it is now.
Plus, we've come a long way as society as far as embracing a comic book. You know, like,
absolutely.
When The Watchmen came out, that shit was just starting.
Yeah.
And now we're, you know, what, almost 20 years down the pike, and you know, like blockbuster, like superhero movie events or cultural events around the world. So, like, mm-hmm. I think people are more primed to accept the weird sci-fi shit that comic books would have to dish up now.
I think so. What'd you think of this guy they picked to play young Wade?
I thought it was good. He had a good, awkward kind of, like, you know, wiry energy. But you still, like, I feel like this is a guy who's motivated out of a desire to do good. I empathize with, because Wade was me, because I very much believed in my mission to go out and, like, inform people about the oncoming Armageddon. Mm-hmm. But I was terrified of it. I hated doing it. Mm-hmm. Like, I saw it was vital work, and like him, like, psyching himself up and like practicing his, what the Jehovah's Witnesses call conversation starters. Mm-hmm. And it's funny, because I thought I remembered this, but I actually did some research, and there were several covers on the Awake and Watchtower magazine throughout the 70s and 80s that liked to feature this atomic scientist. I forget the Alliance of International Atomic Scientists. They're the ones that started this, like, doomsday clock thing. It's a real thing in real life.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I remember there are several covers. I looked up on the internet, several covers featuring the clock. And, you know, that would, yeah, 1985. If it's 1 minute till midnight, I'll be, yeah, I certainly would have been knocking on doors telling people about it.
Oh, yeah. Here's the one thing
I've been a 9-year-old little boy being used as a prop, to you know, for doing right. it. But yeah, yeah.
Yeah, hand him the watchtower, son. Here's the one thing I think they got minorly wrong with the witness stuff, because they get so much right. Like, the idea that Wade would be wearing clip-on tie, right down to that fact, is kind of awesome. I knew plenty of witnesses who wore clip-on ties.
Sure.
Just easier.
Especially when you're witness youth. I mean,
oh, yeah.
You're going to tie ties all the time?
I wore a few myself.
Sure.
The one thing that seemed a little weird to me is these Oklahomans getting off the bus in New Jersey and proselytize, preaching to people there.
They do work where the need is greater, though.
They do, but the need is not
greater
that
great.
Like 10 miles, not even 10 miles, a mile. It's across the river is the headquarters of Jehovah's Witnesses in 1985. So
send in the fucking Bethelites. Take these Oklahomans back home. And
right.
Yeah.
Like, if anything, they'd go out to rural Oklahoma.
Right.
Because I've done that myself.
Sure.
Yeah. You get in a bus or
the Amish country
van.
And have some bewildering conversations with those people.
Like, yeah. Spend a weekend out there doing
it. Why not?
Yeah.
The other thing I think that that was inaccurate is the prayer. Like, there's no way a Jehovah's Witness elder would pray over a bunch of young people and not mention Jehovah once.
Oh,
it's weird that you have it, like, you have the Watchtower announcing Jehovah's Kingdom, but come on, Lindelof, for $5, I'll be a Jehovah's Witness historical accuracy guide.
I do feel they got most of it right, though.
Also, this is Jehovah's Witness in the Watchmen universe, so who knows? Who knows? Maybe that's a fun little cultural quirk about this dimension's Jehovah's Witnesses, that they don't actually use the word Jehovah.
And I was only 3 when this would have been taking place in our universe.
Yeah.
And I don't know how fervent they were, how crazy the witnesses got about the doomsday clock and all that stuff.
Pretty crazy.
But it would push all their buttons.
Sure. Oh, yeah.
A witness wet dream, having the clock at 1 till midnight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because they perversely get so excited when the world gets shitty. Like, when there's lots of earthquakes or a disease or international nuclear tensions, it's like, you know, Armageddon's almost here, you know? Yeah. So.
And this whole event would really fuck with you if you were a religious person who thought this was the end of the world. And you had just, in your mind, sinned.
Yeah.
He walks out of here. He's like, what the fuck happened?
Yeah, no. And I like the, like, internalization of, like, this isn't what, you weren't a normal person who was naive and taken advantage of in a very cruel manner by someone else. It's, you're stupid and you're a sinner and this is all your fault. And
right.
You know, there's this that's a mindset of like, you know, always blaming yourself for every failure rather than say that, like, you know, every once in a while, you know, fuck the other person for doing this to you.
Yeah. And it's something that sticks with Wade for his entire life, we see. So, yeah, let's get there. We go back to modern day. Wade is psychoanalyzing a focused test group. He tells the tourist board that they hated the test group hated their commercial for New York because they're scared. Wade masks up to attend a meeting where Lori says they don't have anything on 7K, so they're going to try and find the church where they made their video.
Yeah, I thought, so here's the debate, I guess, it might be interesting to have. Is Wade really good at detecting lies, or is he got a giant blind spot when it comes to his own personal biases? I think it's the latter, because it does seem like he's pretty good human lie detector, but like he can't see past his own, you know, fears and paranoias. Like, I don't know that I trust his analysis on, like, maybe I trust his analysis on sugar-free cereal. No, not sure if I trust his analysis on a tourism board's trying to revitalize New York's apparently still struggling. Like, yeah, you know, 9/11 attacks have nothing on a psychic squid, because it's put people off in New York City for 30 years plus.
Yeah.
And there's a couple other things where it seems like he is innate, like obviously he's unable to penetrate the truth of the conspiracy around the squid. There's a lot of things, like this will be relevant when he has a conversation with Keen later on. But I just want to point that out, that I think that the limits of his human lie detector are anything that is personally traumatic to him, because he just can't see past his own biases.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. On my first watch, I was like, oh, Wade's got these people pegged. Like, he knows exactly what they're thinking in this focus test group, even though they're not saying it.
Right.
On second watch, I'm like, Wade's full of shit. Wade doesn't know anything about these people.
Yeah.
He's just telling him what he thinks.
I do think that his Looking Glass of Storage Shed hideout is a far more practical hideout than the Sister Knight's fake bakery.
Yeah.
Because, like, yeah, like, people come and go at storage sheds all the fucking time. No one pays any attention to it. You know, no one's going to call Unit 63B and wonder where their fucking dumplings are. Like, Angela's business that's perpetually opening soon, it just is, it's going to be talked about, like, just even in the neighborhood. Like, Jesus Christ, when is this Vietnam? I've been excited for this place for 3 years. When's it going to open? Like, how long is that before it's like people start asking questions? So the storage shed, solid alter ego switching place.
If I were Wade, I'm taking it one step farther. I'm renting the shed behind it as well, and I'm putting a door in.
Yeah, hidden door.
Yeah,
I thought it would be like, I thought there would be a little bit more subterfuge along those lines, like that there would be like a hidden door that bridges the two compartments instead of just having like one big compartment. But
yeah, good enough.
Yeah,
Wade is a man of somewhat limited means, I'm sure.
Surely
he can't have unlimited money.
The department fronts all this, though, right? Is there costumes and gadgetry and all that stuff out of their own budget?
I mean, we speculated this about Angela's bakery. I think they would probably pay something for that, certainly.
Do they have like a superhero stipend?
But Wade like works a job outside of his...
But that's just for cover. Like all
job.
These people do. They...
Right, but he's doing it.
Yeah,
right?
Angela,
where she's just going in there and she doesn't even have eggs in her bakery.
Although I guess she does things like she does baking demonstrations for schools. But yeah, I feel like...
Well, for a kid's school. I had the feeling that was like a bring your parent to school day kind of thing.
I thought it was just like her
career
part of her
day.
Cover. But yeah, it seems like Wade's cover is a lot more aggressive to maintain than Angela's.
And he's probably not sleeping a lot, but I doubt he wants to sleep that much anyway because he probably has nightmares.
True.
A lot of stuff going on. And in this episode, in that commercial that they make for the tourist board, you get to see Christopher from The Sopranos, which I thought was
uncredited.
Nice touch. HBO loves to bring back their actors.
Yeah.
So.
And they got a fine stable. Why not?
All right. We move to Wade getting pissed off that Red made a sandwich from evidence. Angela's pressuring Wade to get the pills analyzed. And then Lori calls Wade into her office to ask about the pills because apparently she bugged his cactus and heard him and Angela talking about him.
She's the FBI. They bug shit.
He just says it's a personal matter.
Hiding behind whatever HIPAA law they have in this dimension. I think there's a lot of interesting things going on here. The fact that Angela is pushing Wade way too hard about something he's obviously uncomfortable about, and something that, you know, she's already putting a lot of trust in him, and he kind of like gives her this subtle like back off, like, you know, you don't demand things of people who you're doing for people for a favor. And she completely blows past that and just like keeps the pressure on. I'm wondering, like, if one or two things had broken a little differently, like if Angela hadn't been so hard pressed on him in this occasion at the end of the episode, if you know, like if would Looking Glass, would Wade have turned traitor if it was just the Keen thing and not a bunch of other things too?
Good question.
Because it also felt like that no one respected him. Like, you know, Judd was using his face for a mirror. This, you know, Lori's calling him mirror guy. Angela's like, you know, taking advantage of their friendship to like hide all this contraband and help him falsify evidence. And it's just like he's clearly motivated by justice and desire to do right. He enlisted right after the White Knight. And, you know, people like that are like ideologically or not ideologically, like principle driven, rather than they're loose cannons or wild cards. Something like this can happen.
Yeah. Is the lettuce thing just to remind us of the lettuce for later in the episode?
Probably. But also, I think it's another annoyance because Wade sees the world as, you know, he's tried to be very professional, precise, and he's planned. And you can tell that he's not really on board with some of the extrajudicial stuff that goes on in the department. And this is just like, in his mind, sloppy and disrespectful.
Yeah, yeah, certainly. We get a little more information about when they wear their masks and where they wear them, which I liked, and also what his mask is made out of. It's a product called Reflectatine, supposed to be impervious to psychic forces.
I wonder if that's actually true, if it's just like, 'cause like,
I assume it's just marketing.
Yeah, because like, you know, they say the same thing about aluminum foil or tin foil today, and obviously that doesn't have any
I don't know, because I'm looking at the drugs. I'm going, okay, nostalgia is a real thing, right?
Yeah.
That's pretty fucking far-fetched.
Right.
Why couldn't Reflectatine be a thing?
And this is a universe that has psychic things like psychic blasts, so I guess that's something you could measure and test. And
but the regulations say keep your mask on in the precinct, which most people do, I think. Certainly, Panda Man, I can't remember his name. He sticks to that.
It's Panda, isn't it? Don't they call him Panda?
Yeah, is that his full name? It might just be a...
He's like Bad Panda, Dirty Panda.
Dirty Panda,
Dirty Panda is what I'm calling him, because, that costume's not been cleaned in a long time.
Fair. All right, Wade goes home for dinner, and an episode of American Hero Story. His squid alarm goes off, and he rushes to his bunker. Unfortunately, his system has malfunctioned, and the alarm won't shut off, so he smashes the system and then calls the company and demands they overnight him a new one. Then he goes to sleep lonely.
Yeah, I had this preconception when I saw this scene and this more and you know, of him like sadly looking around all the other bunk beds, and I'm like, man, did he build this shelter thinking that he would have a family one day and that he wouldn't be this isolated, and now like this anxiety he's had has had him retreat further and further inside himself, inside his underground bunker. And then I watched the actor whose name escapes me at the moment, he was like giving a tour of the bunker as this bonus feature, and they mentioned that like in the backstory that they had in the writer's room and in his head, that him and his dad built this after the Hoboken experience as a way to kind of like bond and get over their shared. So this was like this is the old Wade family squid shelter that he's inherited and he's maintained. And I'm like, well, that fucking blows my headcanon away. But maybe like even still, like maybe he misses the fact that he used to have a family and now he doesn't. Like, that just the look he has in his face while he's pulling down that Reflectatine is just so puppy being put into an incinerator sad.
Yeah, and if you sort of look at it as like, okay, well, this is the thing that sort of drove his family away, right? He's sleeping in this fucking bunker.
Right.
That fear is represented by this bunker, and that's the thing that his ex kept telling him, like, I'm trying to help you get over this.
Conducting over 500 drills.
In who knows how long, but in any amount of time,
middle
that's
of the
a
night,
lot.
In the middle of dinner, like you can imagine, like what a fucking chore it would be to be in a relationship with this guy. Like you have to be a hardcore squid prepper, or you're going to be driven crazy by him.
Yep. Let's move on to Wade getting a page from Cynthia, his ex. He stops by her job where she is cloning pets, and she tells him that the pills are called nostalgia, and they're encapsulated memories that can cause psychosis if taken at too high a dose. And then they talk about their relationship a little bit and why they broke up before he leaves.
Yeah, there's lots more of this information, because like we skipped over the hot and heavy American hero story sex, and but there's a lot of information that's not in the episode that's contained in the the encyclopedia.
You nailed it.
I think that's what it's called, though, isn't that
the encyclopedia? No,
is it the PDPedia? PDPedia. Yeah. It should have been Encyclopedia, I think.
Yeah, that's really good.
Thank you. They have a bunch of information about this that we'll talk right after our episode discussion, I'm assuming, like we have in the weeks before.
I'll say there isn't a ton of like meat on those bones. I thought it was more flavor, but
well, it might be like
a little bit.
It might be. I wonder, like, at some point that, like, these aren't as bombshell because we've been seeing them for so long. There's been so many over the weeks, and we're, like, integrating all the information. So, like, even things that would have been bombshell in isolation aren't.
Plus, there are some legit bombshells in this episode.
Yeah, like, so, like this nostalgia shit, buckle up for next episode, Angela, because holy shit, it's going to be like the scene in Airplane where the doctor's rattling off all the symptoms that you could have if you ate this bad fish and the pilot's undergoing them in real time.
Right.
Like, it's going to be one of those things because, holy moly, the things that can go bad if you overdose on this or take memories that are for another person, pretty bad. Pretty bad. And we'll go into detail here in a bit.
Is this place called Forever Pet?
Yep.
Okay. It's a pet cloning facility staffed entirely by twins, which to me was hilarious.
Yeah, there's definitely something they're saying about clones and how clones are perceived in this world. Mm-hmm. But I wish I knew a little bit more, because it's one thing to think that, like, you know, a person working at the factory will shove a puppy in an incinerator. It's another thing to start thinking about, like, that applied to human clones. But on the other hand, we see how Ozymandias feels about these human clones that he's dealing with over on Europa. So I'm wondering if there's going to be other horrific things that we're going to find out about these Forever Pet technologies or these other labs, these very unethical labs that seem to, like, Lady True is running.
I mean, I guess I thought this was a stupid question before I thought about it. Do you think the people working in that place are clones?
That's what I'm saying. Like, I think there's a strong implication. Like, if not, that's what the marketing wants you to, like, the whole reason you would hire only twins, which, like, my God, how much must you pay? Like, what's the demand?
Yeah. I mean, you'd have to get a lot of people moving there to Tulsa.
Yeah. That's like a lot. I mean, I know twins aren't exactly super rare, but identical twins?
But pretty rare.
Pretty rare to staff exclusive. So it's like the implication, they're not the clones, then I think Forever Pet wants you to think that they're clones. And that's part of, like, the mystique. But
if they aren't clones, how would you ever franchise this thing?
Right?
Like, you can staff maybe one location, two.
And this is the repet in fucking Oklahoma.
Right.
Like, how many repets do they have in New York, in California, in, you know, fucking Seattle, Washington? It's the mind boggles. Yeah. Either these people are getting paid $200 an hour and they relocate them all over the fucking place, and it costs $100,000 to clone a puppy, which it might.
It might.
There's definitely people who would pay for that. Mm-hmm. Or there's a lot of frivolous cloning going on in human society.
Let me ask you this. We're watching two shows right now with pet preservation. Which would you rather have, a clone of your puppy or a stuffed version of your puppy? A la Mr. Robot.
Yeah, see, I really liked the last dog we had. Was this, like, mutt Labrador mix, and he was a real good dog. And I frequently thought, like, if you could, for, like, X amount of money, like, for $5,000, if I could have cloned him. And I didn't give a shit if it didn't have the same brain. Like, it just, like, I liked the physical layout of this dog. I definitely would have done it. So, yeah, or stuffing a dog, I feel like that would just be sad and creepy.
Yeah. I'm with you.
But again, if you know, if there's people, I know that this is a thing that people do, and if you derive comfort from it, there's no wrong way to grieve when it comes to your pets, and don't let my thinking is creepy and weird keep you from getting that solace if you need it, you know?
Okay, we move on to Wade attending an extra-dimensional anxiety support group meeting where he meets Renee. After the meeting, they go to a bar where she tells him about her squid story, and they flirt for a while before they go outside and share a little moment together, a little kiss, and they take off. Or she takes off. When she leaves, she says the lettuce falls out of her truck, which just drives Wade insane, sends him off the deep end. We'll get to the rest of this scene soon because that's kind of a big chunk of it.
Yeah. There's a lot of stuff that I like here. There's like some of the subtle world building, the fact that this 11-2 experience was so traumatic that it hijacked Spielberg's desire to do this black and white concept film, to make it about the Holocaust, to make it about 11-2.
Yeah, I feel like Wade in this scene because I haven't seen Schindler's List.
Yeah.
So I'm the guy who would be going, what's Pale Horse?
They talk about tobacco being a controlled substance, being illegal in the United States, which I thought was kind of interesting.
Assuming that's due to the liberal
president
who's been around for years.
They definitely curtail our freedoms to smoke tobacco, for sure. Just everything she's saying is like red meat for Wade. The fact that like, you know, she understands him. I think even this, her skepticism kind of turns him on. The fact that she casually drops the only time she feels at peace is when she's watching Pale Horse or fucking,
which is designed to, you know, get him going, obviously. Oh, and also after I say the word fucking twice, I'm drunk, by the way. So, yeah.
Yeah. I should
leave.
Follow
me. Yeah, that kind of stuff.
Exactly. Which I think was also probably triggers his like protect. Like, even if the lettuce hadn't fallen out, maybe he'd follow her home to make sure. I don't know. Mm. He seems like the type of guy who would do something that's kind of like well-meaning but creepy.
Yeah, that's creepy.
But yeah, there's also this great song by Sturgill Simpson in the background playing called Turtles All the Way Down, which is his kind of reflections on the life he's led and his experimentation with drugs and psychedelics and different spiritualities and worldviews. And there's name checks and conspiracy theories.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I like this album. I like the song a lot. And I thought it was a nice, clever thing to throw underneath this kind of quasi romantic but ultimately fake date that Wade and what'd you say her name? Renee was having.
Renee, yeah. Which I look at all the really clever, really like subtle things that they're doing in this episode, and then I look at insert shots like the hat or insert shots like the 7K in the church, and I go, why are those in there? How much faith do you have in the audience? Because like you clearly have a lot through most of the show, but then you show these insert shots of like, oh, remember when he put the hat down and there was that reflective material in it? Oh, remember the 7K, like the instigating event of this whole series? You remember that video?
Yeah.
No, here's a shot of it.
Seth and I were kind of debating that too. That it's like it's weird combination of both show and tell. Like, like in the Repet or the Forever Pet or whatever the hell the place was called, where his former wife was saying, you know, Wade, I spent 7 years together with you and I never talked you out of thinking that I was going to leave you behind and naked in a funhouse mirror or whatever. And then they cut back to that scene. Like, if they had, she hadn't said something like that, if she had said something, you know, and Wade in 7 years together, I was never able to break you out of your shell. And then like he kind of like got a 1,000-yard stare and like had the brief flashback, that would have worked. But like her explicitly calling out the thing as we're seeing the thing that we saw 30 minutes before, it is weird.
It's weirdly untrusting of your audience.
It's a weird insecurity that I've not detected from Lindelof. And maybe he's like so fucking out there and up on the high wire that he thinks like, hey, I got it. And obviously people that haven't seen The Watchmen maybe and you know aren't like rolling with some of the stuff with a foundational understanding. He's worried about leaving them behind. But yeah, it's definitely distracting for me who didn't need any of this help.
Right. Speaking of rolling, I did notice that all these cars sound electric to me, which I thought was interesting. I hadn't noticed that before.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if in the very first episode, they showed this guy driving this, F-150 conversion that had like, you know, still had this gas gauge, but like bolted on, there's an electric gauge. So it seems like maybe
But Wade's car is like, it seems like all of them.
Yeah, are. It's probably illegal to drive a gas car outside of like a racetrack or some shit.
I don't remember what Angela's car sounded like.
I'm sure.
Because I hadn't noticed it.
I'm almost positive that every car we've seen has been electric.
Yeah.
Like I said, even if the 7 Cav are driving electric, you know, so it seems like the type that would like to roll coal. They're going to roll coal until the feds take their shitty, dirty engines out of their cold, dead hands. I think it must be some kind of fucking liberal bullshit legislation.
I mean, the biggest thing, obviously, about the scene is that Wade is completely unable to detect this lie, this subterfuge going on.
Yeah.
And I do feel like it's mixed up with, you know, the fact that she's flirting with him, that she's leading him down that path. It sort of distracts him. Yep. And you see this exact same thing having happened 30 years ago in 1985, which is kind of like... Alarm bell should be going off in his head, but it seems to be a blind spot, right? When something is clearly not right. But sex is involved, yeah. Wade seems to have some kind of blind spot.
Yeah, it's the squid, it's the sex. I think it's interesting. I got this from a post on Reddit, but he at one point in the conversation with Renee, he says, "I've never been able to get that one-eyed devil out of my mind." Mm-hmm. And there's a scene where
he's talking about his dick. He's talking about his dick. Yeah.
No, there's actually a scene where this girl's seducing him at the Hoboken Fair, where she is doing her makeup and she looks through her compact mirror and you can just see her eye, her single eye.
Pretty
so
cool.
Like it's a double meaning, like both the squid and this very formative experiences in Wade's mind. And yeah, like massive blind spots. And also I wonder if you're supposed to understand that he's not really good at lie detecting. Like Lori, who is a character who I guess I trust more than most, she seems like she's got a pretty clear-headed view, been on both sides of this law enforcement thing. She's pretty skeptical about this racism detector. Mm-hmm. Like it seems like this is almost cold reading, like what a magician or a supposed psychic would do to find out about what your dead Uncle Roger wanted to tell. You know, like he's trying things, he's reading people, but I don't think he's got... I'm doubting that he has any kind of like superhuman or even well-trained lie detector.
Yeah.
I could be wrong.
Which I wasn't earlier. Like this episode is the one that cemented it for me.
Yeah. But I could also be wrong. And they're just suggesting that in areas where he has personally experienced trauma, that he is unable to determine the truth or lie of that. So maybe he's a very good racist detector.
Could be. I also find the idea that a human being would be the thing to try and detect a lie to be a little squicky. Just because they're so subject to influences, from in many forms. Mm-hmm. But I mean, bribery, blackmail, many things that you could have him walk into a room and say somebody who's innocent is guilty, and have them believe it.
Well, plus that's like even you know there are techniques you can tell when mm-hmm. people are lying, but there are also techniques that you can. Master.
Sure.
Like you can, you know, like you can beat a lie detector. If it's human nature to like break eye contact or to lie, you can train yourself to not do that. So it's like one of those
just
things
put a
where
tack in your shoe. That's what I learned.
Right. Yeah. From the Amazing Randy. It's an interesting like game where like you're professional at detecting lies of amateurs.
Okay.
Yeah. And like the lies you really want to detect in society are probably the trained professional ones because mm-hmm. they've got something more than just a crime of passion or like a momentary lapse of judgment they're trying to cover. They're like running these big scams. And you see the Robert Redfords, the Lady Trues, the Senator Keens, they are skating by, you know, looking glasses gaze where, you know, these poor ignorant white people of Nixonville are getting worked over.
Which is hilarious because nothing came of that. Like they interrogated every single person and they found nothing.
Yep.
Pretty hilarious to me. And tragic and fucked up.
Right.
All right, we move on to Wade following this truck to a warehouse where he calls for backup but moves in before they show up. Turns out the whole evening has been a setup and he's captured by the 7K. Senator Keen reveals himself and that he and Judd have been working with the 7K as peacekeepers since the White Knight. Keen also says they're going to use the teleporters they've been working on for something, although he says it's going to be more creative than a squid. Then he shows him a video that Ozymandias made for President Redford upon his inauguration, revealing that the squid attack was a hoax. just fucking blows his mind.
I think the backdrop of Ozymandias on this DVD or optical disc is the squid eye itself, it seemed to me. And I kept on thinking that they would pan out and you'd see him standing in like a hangar that has this giant squid in it or something.
That makes a lot of sense.
I'm wondering if we'll see other clips of this, or if this is just going to be like one of those like after Watchmen issues where you have like a excerpt for Night Owl's memoir, or an excerpt from a psychological profile of Rorschach. Like there's like this little odd little in-universe media clips that they're embedding, and that's also like part of the Pediafiles thing too.
Yeah, I mean it'd be great if they filmed 2-3 hours of content.
I would love
with Jeremy
it. I
want to
see it all,
laying it all out, and put that on the PDF.
I want to see his. I want to see his version of Utopia. Yeah. I want all that on the Blu-rays for sure.
There's no fucking way they did that though, right?
No.
2-3 hours of filming of footage would take hours and hours of time of Jeremy Irons that they just don't want to pay for.
Yeah, maybe a chapter or two. Joke. Maybe like a 10, maybe another 10 or 15 minutes.
Yeah, yeah. Key moments from it. Yeah, that'd be cool.
Because like if it's a like a 10-part plan and we see like parts 2 and 3 or something, I think that would be interesting.
Yeah.
There's a lot more to talk about here.
Yeah.
I thought there's interesting play with the fact that one of the primary, I think, antagonists in the series is a lady by the name of True, and you know Wade asserting something that's not true. And then, you know, Keen coming back, is anything true? Mm-hmm. And also, like, I thought I remember thinking in the when I first saw this, that like there's got to be some connection to what Lady True is doing and what Keen and Judd were trying to do with the Seven Cavalry here. And when I watched the next, what jumped them out is we need to take Angela off the board for a couple of days. Mm. And we also know that we're 2 or 3 days. I think we're 3 days away, and now we're another day into the thing. So, like a couple, referring to, you know, colloquially, a couple means two, right? Mm-hmm. There can't be coincidence that their doomsday projects or their big reveal is going to happen at the same date and time. Can't be. They have to be working together.
Well, I mean, I don't know. They have to be working together, but I think you're right about it happening at the same time.
Yeah,
I think they could be still opposing each other, but Lady True knows about their plans and has plans to thwart them. Maybe.
Well, it's like I think there's an analog here with Ozymandias in the comic, where he took writers and artists and scientists and got them all believing in his project, but then at the end he killed them all. Mm-hmm. To protect, you know, the subterfuge. And I wonder if Lady True is doing the same thing, where she's harnessing all these different departments and forces and things that maybe and she's telling them, because like it wasn't like Ozymandias was going to everybody and be like, hey, Moloch, I'm going to infect you with cancer as if just a small part of a long-term plan to discredit Dr. Manhattan, destroy his confidence. You know, it was quite the opposite. He told Molek what Molek wanted to hear to get him on board, and had nothing to do with, you know, destroying 3 million people with a psychic blast. Like,
yeah,
Lady True could be through different intermediaries recruiting these people, and they have no idea what part they're playing. They just know they're playing a part, and maybe they even think they're the ones in control.
Yeah, well, I mean, that last part is what's curious to me, because Will clearly has some control over this plan, right? This is not entirely Lady True's plan when Angela.
She's nervous that he could do something to stop it if he wasn't all in. So yeah, he must have some kind of linchpin part of it.
Yeah, so they're working together, but it doesn't seem like he's working for her as much as like they are together. And you know, Keen is very much concerned about the death of Judd and Will and like all that stuff. Clearly he didn't plan any of that.
Mm-hmm.
So like, at the least, Will and Keen and Judd are all working on opposite sides, but maybe Lady True is pulling strings.
Well,
on
there's
both
also
sides.
Like what you believe about Wade's lie detector informs the scene too, because Keen Jr. says that, hey, me and Judd have been working together, maintained the peace ever since the White Knight, and Wade looks right at him and says, that's not true.
And this is very confusing to me, because we've just been shown that his lie detector is completely bogus, at least in certain scenarios. Yeah. Is this one of those scenarios?
It doesn't have anything to, well, I mean, that's where I wonder if Damon Lindelof is not intentionally playing with our expectations and what we're getting, because like, if what you and I say is true and he's compromised in terms of like you know, sexuality and squid attacks, then mm-hmm. being able to suss out whether a white nationalist is lying about his true motivations for commandeering a white supremacist organization, he could be right on in saying that that's not true. But if his lie detector is just a bunch of bullshit all around,
right?
And, or this is adjacent enough to the squid thing, where like he's freaked out about the portals and everything, then maybe not. And it's kind of an interest. It's a brilliant storytelling tactic because it can be both true and not true, and it's all in your interpretation. And who knows? Like, we're not going to know until, you know, like this looking glass guy is almost like a Schrodinger's cat. Is he going to be good? Is he ultimately mm-hmm. going to be bad? Is he going to be good but misguided? Like he's been, it seems like, his whole life. That's the interesting part of his character.
Yeah, I wonder if the truth, whatever form it takes, is going to set him free or destroy him.
Where are you on the squid pro quo line?
I love it.
Yeah?
It's the best thing about this episode.
Is that something
yes.
they've looped in the last... They had to loop back in the last couple... Because I feel like quid pro quo has exploded in the popular consciousness as a result yeah. of this impeachment hearing.
Okay.
And I'm wondering if, like, was there always a squid pro quo? Mm-hmm. Or did they bring back Bob Benson back to loop that line?
If it was Jeremy Irons saying the line, I'd say
no fucking way.
Yeah. But it's Bob Benson. Like, yeah. come on.
Yeah. Plus, Jeremy Irons seems like he's the type of guy who would, you know, come back for a day's work in front of a green screen to stick it to Trump. You know, if he wanted
probably.
To like throw in a little squid pro quo.
I don't know anything about his politics. He's in Die Hard 3, for God's sake.
Yeah.
He's got some pretty fucked up politics.
It's true.
So they do kind of confirm. It depends on how much you believe of this scene.
Mm-hmm.
They do kind of confirm the Will killed Judd and that the 7K had nothing to do with it.
I do believe that for sure.
Yeah, and we do get more insight into why Judd might have looked like a 7K member, assuming again that you believe any of this stuff. He was trying to keep the peace after what was a horrific event, the mm-hmm. attack of the White Knight.
Mm-hmm.
There's just a lot of reveals here, you know, a lot of information in this scene. And we haven't even talked about fucking teleporters. We haven't talked about Ozymandias' plan for the future.
Yeah, and also, like, what is the... So, whether they're working for Lady True or not, like, what is the 7th Cavalry going to do with a teleportation gun, the teleportation portal that's not going to be dropping a psychic squid? Like, what are they...
I don't know.
And it
something
also...
Something more creative is what they say.
Just as a outside critic of their project, it seems like they're not nearly far enough along if they're in the, hey, let's throw a basketball and detect where it goes phase of... Like, they're not 2 days away from doing anything.
What if you took a garden hose
mm-hmm.
and you ran some nostalgia through it?
Okay.
And you rained that down instead of squids?
What would a dimensional... Oh, so I...
Because we presume they're like, using the portals to rain
squids. You disperse
squid.
It in the high atmosphere and just have it rain down
yeah.
nostalgia? Jesus Christ, what kind... Whose memory? And like, you know, like,
yeah.
It seems like it's very dangerous to do memories that are not your own, so, like, it's a big... Of course, they're...
There were a lot of deaths
in the
original. The
7th Cavalry, I don't know that there's any amount of collateral that they wouldn't accept to get their ethno state going again.
And I mean, in the spirit of Ozymandias, they wouldn't give a fuck about the collateral damage. It's all about the end.
But I mean, Ozymandias would still, it's like, there's like, I don't know, if the damage that the psychic squid did was greater than like a nuclear war, he'd probably feel like an asshole.
Oh, yeah, he wouldn't have done it.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah, because it's like, yeah, take the risk with the mushroom clouds. I don't know.
And also, you got to wonder how smart Senator Keene and Judd Crawford were. They're no Ozzy. Ozzy's the smartest person on the planet in existence.
Yeah.
He planned this for years and years and years. Are they going to be able to replicate his success?
I don't think so.
Doubt it.
No, I think that Lady True might. She's the one that's been doing the... it's just... I'm very curious to see how this is all going to like arc back together.
Mm-hmm. It's also, I think, notable that Ozzy's plans for Utopia didn't come true.
No.
I mean, certainly the 7K White Knight attack would not be part of that plan, I wouldn't think.
In fact, it's not even like a half-realized Utopia. It seems like people are living as many in anxiety and despair as they were. Like, maybe mm-hmm. the world's not ending, you know? Like, I guess that's an improvement. Like, there's not any, like, 1 minute to midnight that we've seen.
Yeah, but he laid out a lot of things for his Utopia, right?
Yeah.
I mean... he's talking about Star Trek type utopia.
Yeah.
And I don't see that any of that came true. Now, I have to wonder, when he dropped off the scene 7 years ago, is that when things started to go bad?
Nah,
was he still masterminding? Because that's the thing,
like, I just don't think you can brute force a utopia. Like, you can't have this revolution and put all the right people against the wall and put a bullet in them, and then everything's going to be fine. Like, mm-hmm. I think that mankind is capable of this. It's just going to take generations of slowly moving it to not be focused on your own survival and maximization of your own benefit to, like, maximization of your fellow man, like, you know, making sure everyone has a fair shot, making sure everyone's taken care of. I don't think you can do that with a psychic squid or, you know, any kind of legislation. Like, that's just a patient work of, like, education. And, you know, once you get a certain part of the globe kind of squared away, then it's going to be like, how do you, you know, like, the very idea of what I'm saying is scary to people. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, conservatives have been afraid of this one world order for, like, ever since I was growing up. Like, oh my God, what if these lunatics take over the whole world and force us to do that? And, like, even if forcing us is to, like, love each other, that's a terrifying concept, because what mm-hmm. does that even mean? And, you know, like, what's the tension between caring for the community and individual freedoms and liberties? So it's like Ozymandias had his head up his ass from the jump. Like, that's why I think he's a crazy supervillain. Like, I know Jeremy Irons is, like, really super charming and all that, but, like, don't forget that this man is like a Lex Luthor type.
Mm-hmm. He's a mass murderer.
It's just as wrong to think that he's the hero of the story as it is to think that Rorschach's the hero.
Yeah,
so.
Absolutely. Yeah, the idea of, like, him kind of keeping the peace for, you know, X amount of years, 23 years or something,
mm-hmm.
Is sort of like this unearned utopia, right? Like, even if it was a utopia, let's say, even though it doesn't seem like it was,
mm-hmm.
If he had attained that utopia, like, an unearned utopia is a very fragile one, because as soon as the thing that's just keeping it all together is absent, the utopia crumbles, because nobody ever came to the opinion that we should have these values, honestly.
Yeah. Yeah.
They were forced into them. They were tricked into them, right?
Right. And, like, you know, once you have a generation or two that's comfortable with the idea, the squids reign, but, like, it's, you know, that was, like, a one-time thing, and then you're back to square one.
We already see, like, the effects of the squids fading. Like Renee says, right, there are fucking squids raining from the sky and nobody gives a shit anymore.
Right, yeah.
The alarm goes off, they squeegee their windows, and they're back about their day. Like,
all means, like, imagine, you remember the terrorist threat level? Like, how that was announced on the news?
Oh, yeah.
And, like, that's what I'm saying. Like, yeah, it's like, I don't know that the world is especially safer right now, but, like, the fear of terrorism is receding because it's not no longer a thing that is happening on a regular basis, or when it's happening, it's, like, small. It's like we're just inured to it. So,
mm-hmm.
yeah, no, it's there's a lot of really interesting satire and commentary going on. It almost seems like this show is too ambitious. I was following a couple conversations on Twitter where people are like, it's crazy how, on top of all the race commentary that's going on here, there's also a 9/11 kind of conspiracy commentary. Mm-hmm. And, like, maybe it was too ambitious to try to do something with both of those, that it's going to make either one of them weaker. That, like, it's a big ask to get everybody on board with, like, some of this racial conspiracy stuff. And then you throw on, like, 9/11, like, I mean, in this scenario, like, the 9/11 truthers would be right. Right.
Yes.
You know, that there is a big 11-2 worldwide truthers, yeah, 11-2 truthers are all the craziest conspiracy theorists in this world I've proven to be true. And is the show prepared to, like, follow through with that worldview?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. That's a lot to put on your plate.
So here's what I like about what they're doing, what the Lindelof et al. Are doing with mm-hmm. this show is the same thing he did with Leftovers, right? He takes this big event and he just kind of spins out from there and says, how would characters react to this? Like, he enables some kind of personal storytelling around these big events that speaks to a certain truth about humans in general.
Mm-hmm.
Even if the scenario is ridiculous, like, the event is stupid, something that could never happen in the real world, you're always kind of grounded in these strange events by the characters.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something that I felt maybe was missing in the first episode, but there's a lot of world building. And then episode after episode, he's continued to layer those characters on.
Yeah.
And that's really what's hooked me in the last few weeks.
Yeah. Well, they talked last week about like Lady True building an empathy bomb. And I think that's mm-hmm. what The Leftovers was. And yeah. maybe it's what he's trying to do with the Watchmen too. It's like, not necessarily want to change people's mind, but like, hey, consider this other perspective.
Yeah.
On grief, consider this other perspective on race relations, consider this other perspective on, I don't know, that's where it breaks down when I get to this particular commentary, because like,
yeah,
it's weird. Where is he going with it?
All right, we go over to Ozzy, who is his experiment is ready enough for him to catapult himself into the air, and he does so, and he makes it outside of the atmospheric bubble that he's been living in, revealing that he is on one of Jupiter's moons, which I think you call that as Europa during the instant take, and I agree.
Yeah,
there was likely one.
Someone did a side-by-side comparison between a NASA simulation of the surface of Europa and that, and they're like identical.
Yep.
So, yeah, I think Europa is a pretty good candidate for his prison.
So he's way out there. He uses the numerous frozen bodies of Mr.
also,
Phillips.
Yeah, there's an interview I read where Lindelof confirmed that, too. I forgot.
Oh, like, he did?
Yeah, okay. I must have forgot to update my notes on that. But, yeah, it's definitely Europa.
Okay. So he uses the numerous frozen bodies of Mr. Phillips and Mrs. Crookshanks to spell out, save me something?
Daddy.
I'm daddy. Still save me, daddy. Just as a satellite camera passes by. And he is then yanked back into the atmospheric bubble by the game warden and told there will be consequences for his actions and he will not have any mercy.
There's a nice, I mean, you know, obviously using heaps of bodies to escape a hopeless situation is very fucking Black Freighter, which is very fucking Watchmen. Also, like him raising his arms in triumph and screaming, I did it, is exactly what he did in the comics when he pulled off his big scheme. Save me, D. The one thing that we didn't that had some currency that we didn't, I think, you know, we had the whole save me like Dr. Manhattan or just Doc. Save me D could also be Dan, which is
okay,
the
Freeberg,
the identity of the Night Owl, mm-hmm. which they've also talked about perhaps being released this season from prison. He's also, you know, very wealthy. He had cutting edge technology that him and Manhattan worked together on. If I was to name one person that wasn't Lady True that would have the resources to maybe do something about Ozymandias' predicament, he would be one of them.
Okay.
But I don't know. It's also pretty fucking late to introduce his character into a story.
Yeah, he's still in prison. It's pretty late both in terms of the season, but also in terms of like this doomsday clock that's ticking down. We've got 2 days left before some big event happens.
And he got in prison in 95 or 97, I forget which. Either way, way before Ozymandias got exiled. So, and Ozymandias would know that. So, you know, what else could it be? It's got to be Dr. Manhattan. But we also think after this, a lot of things he was saying to the game warden, a lot of things the game warden was saying to the Mr. Phillips and Mrs. Crookshanks of the world implied that there was a literal god, which, you know, Manhattan kind of fills that criteria. Mm-hmm. It does feel pretty Manhattan-y. Like I said, I believe that maybe Lady True could put a prison on a moon, maybe put one on Mars, but like fucking a moon of Jupiter, whew.
Stuff,
especially since it's near magical, you can just launch out of it's got perfect gravity and but it's also as soon as you get to a certain altitude,
she's
you're
expert at constructing artificial habitats.
That's true, but does it go to gravity and force fields that contain atmosphere? And
I don't know, man. She's fucking making memory drugs.
True. Yeah, I mean, that's
literally distilling memories into drug form. I have no idea what you can do.
There's enough sci-fi fantasy in this that it is just possible. But also, would Ozymandias refer to her as a god in this context? Like, your god has abandoned you? I guess it could if she created all this and put it in motion.
Could be. Yeah. I do think that the game warden, we were wondering if he's a Mr. Phillips or not. I think he is.
Yeah,
he
saw
just has
that
a mustache, and he looks like him.
And I think, as someone pointed out, he was credited on IMDb as the same actor. So,
yeah.
That, I don't know if that complicates things or not.
No, I don't think so. I think Mr. Phillips and Crookshanks just serve all the functions here.
It would be interesting if The one thing that could hint to Lady True is if these clones, once they're pulled out of their cloning vat and matured, they're given this nostalgia that has like a base, like programmatic memory for these servants to do the things they need to do for Ozymandias, like that maybe is a little bit of a Lady True. Because otherwise, I'm trying to think of like how would you create a human that would just like after a few hours of maturing would just have full function language and base like skills. You don't have to teach them to walk. You don't have to teach them how to groom themselves. That would be useful as like a loading, like a booting, a ROM. You know,
and they talk about the genetic memory too.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
There's some possibility that's just built into them.
Yeah, it's like this is instinctual. It's like crazy to think about. It's a very science fiction thing, but this show's getting really sci-fi.
Yeah, there's a shitload of stuff that I want to talk about when we get to that nostalgia brochure from the PDpedia later. Mm-hmm. But let's get to some of the final scenes here. Wade is distracted at his day job because of what he's learned.
It's a nice transition between the game warden saying there'll be no mercy, and then there's a woman spraying a fragrance called mercy.
Yeah, in one of those focus groups. He questions everything about his life, and he gets to the precinct where he tells Angela what the pills are and gets her to dish on Will's ties to Judd's death and her reaction to that, which is all caught on his bugged cactus. Lori charges out of her office and arrests Angela, but not before she can down the entire bottle of nostalgia, which will have consequences.
Oh boy, will it.
At the beginning of the scene, there are a couple of cops talking about Dr. Manhattan and Hooded Justice. He says, I've watched every episode. He's talking about American Hero Story. Watched every episode. Hooded Justice is Dr. Manhattan, which I think is leaning once again into the speculation by fans. It's tough to say whether this is Lindelof anticipating the speculation that's going to happen or actually planting seeds for future reveals.
Yeah.
Foreshadowing. I don't know the difference anymore.
Yeah. I mean, I think part of running a puzzle box, if you're a showrunner in this age, is like, you know, the concept of like chaff and like a radar, like, you know, you throw a bunch of like shards of aluminum foil in the air to fool a radar seeking missile or something, give it a radar target to lock onto. And you got to do that. Mm-hmm. You got to have like these red herrings and you have to be ever more subtle. They have to be plausible, but again, ultimately makes still the main narrative make sense. You know, you can't bury it so deep that people are like, well, actually, the red herring sounds like a better story. I don't envy anyone trying to do it in this day and age. And I feel like the Lindelof has got a new kind of pioneering technique where it's just like, didn't we talk about another show doing this too? Because we know like the Watchmen or Westworld season 2 is an example of something that didn't necessarily succeed. And like Mr. Robot season 2, also one of these puzzle boxes that didn't necessarily like depended on that reveal, and people had figured it out like 5 weeks in advance. Like the way to these puzzle boxes is mini puzzles that you open along the way. Like instead of one big one, it's like a series. It's almost like an advent calendar of like, oh, you open door one and two and you think, you know, what's door. I know where this is going. And door three just gives you the answer.
Right.
But then also there's another puzzle and I feel like that's a better way to go, because you can fool the internet for a week or two. Mm-hmm. And then that's when you let them feel clever and like, yep, pat on the back. Good job. And while they're doing these micro puzzles, maybe you can assemble some kind of like Constructicon giant puzzle out of it.
Well, I think that's the thing that Lindelof tried to do with Lost.
Yeah.
And it didn't work because it's too big of a puzzle.
Plus, he admitted that he had no idea where he was going. I mean, that's the fatal flaw. If you don't know where you're landing when you take off, then you're just trusting in dumb luck to get you there.
Yeah, but since then, he seems to have gone with more micro puzzles, right?
Yeah.
Like he goes with the episodic puzzles, but then he also goes with the season arc of a puzzle.
Yeah.
Where you're questioning, you know, a lot of you're questioning a pretty big thing, but it's not what plane of existence are these people on, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And it's not going to be basically stalled on until, you know, season 6.
Yeah.
He's able to do it just one season at a time now, which I think works really well.
Uh-huh. And Leftovers even wasn't like, it was just a good character study in like puzzle box clothing. Mm-hmm. You know, like it. The central mysteries. He's were always never had the that. Point.
Like Lost has great character.
Sure, sure.
Development,
but also that wasn't like, you know, why people were obsessively creating wikis sure. and doing podcasts and yeah. YouTube videos and all that kind of stuff. You know, that wasn't people why people are freeze framing on a shark's tail. Mm-hmm. You know, like. But yeah, I definitely it's this is a lot more Lost like I think than The Leftovers. So I'm really curious to see
you're right.
How successful he's able to do just like a nakedly like, oh yeah, this is a puzzle box. It is a mystery. We're in this together. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying it's not the point, like Leftovers, like, oh yeah, the mystery's not the point. Like, no, this is the point. I'm curious to see how he lands it.
Yeah, it's the point of the original Watchmen too in some ways. So mm-hmm.
And that squid, like, fucking, even though, yeah. like, that's the amazing thing is, like, the squid comes out of nowhere, but when you reread it, there's, like, all these, like, isolated vignettes of, like, this tropical island where people are painting weird shit and talking about this weird, like, it all makes sense, mm-hmm. but no one, like, you don't get to that final issue and think, oh, yeah, I know what's going to happen. Yeah. Giant fucking psychic squid's going to be dropped on New York City. Like,
right.
So you're trying to live up to that source material.
Speaking of not knowing what's going to happen, there's something that I couldn't help but think about at the end of this scene mm-hmm. when LG gives up Angela with this cactus, right? Because so it's remarked upon by LG earlier in the episode that Lori knows his fucking name. Lori knows it's not Mirror Guy. Mm-hmm. It's Looking Glass, but she calls him Mirror Guy.
Mm-hmm.
Which sort of to me is paralleled in the idea that Lori knows that Wade knows about this bug cactus, right? And so when he gives up Angela, it's intentional.
Yes.
She's got to wonder what made him turn on her.
Angela?
No, Lori has to wonder what made Wade turn on Angela.
Hmm.
At the end of the episode, that would be my biggest question. Why the change of heart here? Because he was stonewalling
her. So you're
before.
Saying, like, wonder to the point of suspicion?
Because I would certainly be curious if I were Lori.
Because, like, I didn't have that thought, but, like, now that I'm thinking about it, I guess, you know, you got to question how cynical and suspicious Lori is, and the answer is very.
Very. Yeah, very. Very. Yeah. Fucking.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And LG, you know, he got mixed up in some bad shit to get this revelation. Yeah. And have his mind changed. So Lori's not in on that shit as far as I know. So she's going to have to go. I assume this is going to be her avenue to start investigating the larger 7K conspiracy.
Mm-hmm.
She's going to now have both angles, right? She's got the 7K angle through Wade and she's got the Will Lady True angle through Angela.
Right.
And we'll probably see this investigation spin out further.
Mm-hmm.
All right. We go to the final scene where Wade goes home to find his new alarm unit waiting on his doorstep. He throws it in the trash, but he decides to go back for it. Once inside, the 7K roll up to his house with weapons and march to his front door.
They look like they're up to no good.
They sure do. They sure do. Why does he go back and grab this unit?
Man, I don't have any further analysis I didn't have on instant take, which okay. is... I can't tell whether... Because I do know that... You know, having been through a couple bombshell revelations that completely changed how I saw the life, it wasn't like, you know, using example of being a Jehovah's Witness, it wasn't like one day I woke up and I was exposed to a piece of information. I'm like, oh, this is garbage. Never again. It's more of like a seed of doubt forms mm-hmm. and then another seed and another seed. And you try to prune and cut them out. And then, so like the idea that Wade would go from a person who and an organization that he would not have an inclination to trust and see this one video and like it would certainly be a crisis of conscience.
Mm-hmm.
But is it something that where he's ready to completely throw out how he lived his life? So are we supposed to understand that him getting the EDS is like, you know, him still clinging to that? You know, because he doesn't know what else to do, or is he going to do something interesting with that, like repurpose that alarm to do something with it that's going to be, you know, I'm reminded of like, you know, Rorschach's one-man army against the cop routine that he did when they took him into custody. Are we going to see like this crazy improvised, you know, fight? Or but also, why would Looking Glass be on the guard against that? Like, why would he think these guys... I think it's not... if Looking Glass is as smart as he think that I think he is, then he would probably at least medium suspect treachery, because mm-hmm. the natural thing to do is once the 7th Cavalry's got from him what they needed, which is taking Angela off the board, would be to eliminate him to protect their benefactors mm-hmm. and their overall mission, because he's a loose end for all the reasons I just talked about.
Absolutely.
So what do you think?
Yeah, I do think that this is him sort of not... either not wanting to believe what he's just been told, or being so up in the air on what the hell truth is, that going back to his comfort zone, the place that he's lived most of his life, is probably what he's doing.
Mm-hmm.
I just think beliefs die hard, like you were saying. You don't just change them immediately, even when presented with overwhelming evidence.
Yeah, and he keeps on, like, what he said to Angela, like, what is true, that repetition, it's like... is he onto the Lady True thing, or is this going to trigger, like, you know, is this going to make sense to her in retrospect after she goes through what I'm sure is going to be a trippy fucking experience next episode?
I didn't even think maybe Lady True is mixed up in this Ozzy video.
Huh.
Because we don't know. There's multiple hours of shit that we don't get to see that Looking Glass did. So, yeah, I don't know.
I don't either.
Damn fine question. But that's the end of the episode. Do we want to talk about the PDpedia?
Yeah, this week's PDpedia had three entries. The first one was a memo from Agent PD himself about the American Hero story, More Infernal Affairs. It's his report on the historicity and how his commentary on the episode. And he is concerned, as he has been in weeks before, about how Agent Blake will be affected by the portrayal of her mother's assault. I don't know what to make of that, because I think that this is happening in, like, real time. And that this is after he's had a sexual encounter with Agent Blake, mm-hmm. but he also expressed kind of a desire to be sensitive towards her before he even was assigned to her as a partner. So I'm not sure what to read into that, if anything.
Yeah. And he conspicuously, if that is true and these are real time, he does not mention, he mentions that he is, compromised by his lack of context over the episode,
mm-hmm.
having not seen the previous one, but he does not acknowledge that he may have banged Lori.
There's another thing that's a
compromising
conflict
factor
of interest there between his head and his dick.
Yeah.
There's also some kind of like this humorous world building that Silk Spectre, apparently post Watchmen, starred in a one woman show called Baby This Is Tops that was performed exclusively on regional cruise ships,
uh-huh.
and something called the Supper Spa Circuit. I mean, that says geriatric all over it. Supper spa. Oh, yeah. Let's go. Spa. Hey, Maude, let's go have supper and then get rubbed down.
I don't. Supper in a sauna? I'm not interested.
Also, the Hood of Justice and Silk Spectre dated briefly, but it's more of a like a sham affair for publicity. She said that she never saw him under the hood, never saw any other piece of him. That he was also very careful about what he said about himself. And one of the things that allowed her to, because there's also this implication that like she wanted to maybe take the comedian to the police and report the sexual assault. But her agent, who later became her husband, said it would be bad for the group. And also Hood of Justice wouldn't testify in court because he'd have to reveal himself, and he wasn't going to do that. Also, we kind of put this together last week, but it's confirmed that Lori took the gig as an FBI agent as part of her condition of her plea deal that she made with the government.
Yeah.
After being apprehended for stopping the Oklahoma City bombings. PD has kind of a pretty, on point critique of American Horror Story. American Hero Story. Sorry. American Hero Story copying the shot structure for Sally's assault. And Hood of Justice and Captain Metropolis's sex, the shot on that, very making him identical, which serves to make Sally kind of a prop in the Hood of Justice hero journey, rather than the story of her sexual assault being about her.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I never really pieced together in the timeline is that when this happened, that Sally was 20 and Eddie, the comedian, was only 16.
Yeah.
Like, they're always portrayed as very mature adults in film and even the comics, so...
Yeah, when I look at JDM, I don't think 16-year-old in Watchmen.
No.
But, you know, liberties.
There's also this interesting thing, because, like, I remember, like, 2 weeks ago, I got the very clear implication that Petey is uncomfortable with, like, you know, gay, lesbian topics, that he is very one of those people that don't mm-hmm. like the term toxic masculinity. But here he says that he's all in favor of telling of LGBT stories, but he just thinks that Hood of Justice is a bad vehicle for advancing the cause because his story is so filled with complications and paradoxes. I don't know. To me, this commentary smacked of like people like, hey, I don't got any problems with gay people, but Jesus Christ, why did I have to put a trans person in my video game?
Right.
You know, it's like there's an appropriate way to tell that story, but do you have to shove it in my face? Like,
and the appropriate way, according to them, would be to not tell it.
Yeah. Just to be like, hey, do I even have to know they're gay? You know, like I still think I'm getting a little whiff of some cultural discomfort that PD's having with this material above and beyond his concerns for how historical it may or may not be.
Yeah.
Any other commentary on that particular one?
Not that one.
Because then we have a piece of media, which is a promotional flyer for a new drug hitting the market in 2007, Nostalgia.
Developed by True Industries, so.
Indeed. Apparently, it's a customized psychoactive compound that's derived from the patient's brain and corticosteroids that they withdraw from a patient or properly matched blood relative, which is going to be, I'm sure, pertinent to what goes on with Angela's brain next episode.
I think that'll be the saving grace, is that, you know, they are related, and so she's not going to go completely out of her mind.
Right, right. And probably is going to interact with her genetic trauma. There's also the aside that these pills are color-coded, with red being the most intense experience, and Angela just downed a bright red bottle of these things.
She sure did.
There is a bolded warning to never take someone else's nostalgia, because mm-hmm. they're custom coded and it can have bad effects. Also, something interesting about this drug can be absorbed by a developing fetus.
So this is super interesting, I think.
Which makes me think about Lady True's daughter.
Yes.
Yeah.
And what the chemicals that she might be IVing at night are. Yeah. Do you think that they're nostalgia, or do you think there's some sort of suppressant because...
Ooh.
When she was born, the
under the effects of nostalgia,
right, from her mother, the transfer of those memories was so intense, and she's trying to sort of suppress that stuff so her daughter can...
How old do we think Lady True's daughter is? Because honestly,
like 12, 13.
Oh, really? Because I was thinking, always thought she was like college co-ed age, but...
Oof.
She's dressed very cutesy, but I know she always, I don't know, but it's,
yeah, but
she could be 12 or 23. I don't know, but cause I was trying to do the math. Nostalgia was introduced to public in 2007. So maybe it's been worked in Lady True's labs for 5 years, and that was 12 years ago. So that I could buy that she's certainly 18, 19 years old. And that's
if she were 20 something. Yeah. There's no way. Yeah. The time works out.
You don't think so? If she was fucking with this on her own,
yeah,
5 years before
it
went, because this is five. Like, so this is the FDA's approved.
It hits the market. Yeah.
Yeah. So maybe, and that's an interesting take, that she's trying to suppress the influence rather than achieve the
right. Because she didn't have like a super clear memory of the event, and this says that like these effects,
vivid.
Like you get very vivid, extreme empathetic effects.
Yeah, if she wanted it to be very vivid, she has the technology to make that happen. So that's right. An interesting alternate take.
And it also makes me wonder about the baby that she gave to these farmers. Does that is that tampered with somehow with nostalgia? And
holy shit.
Like, I don't know.
It would be interesting. Oh, what if that's what True is really doing? She's replacing the nation's infants with clones that have nostalgia that are going to be naturally more empathetic towards people. And that's one way to engineer utopia.
One baby at a time.
One developing fetus at a time. Also should not be taken by those under 18 as it impairs development, which regardless of what you think is going on with Lady True's daughter, if she's given her nostalgia and she's under 18, then that's bad. Symptoms of an overdose include heart attack, respiratory distress, sleeping sickness, catatonia, psychic looping, incessant weeping, laughing or screaming, random or irregular erections or vaginal wetness, involuntary orgasms, explosive flatulence or diarrhea, kidney, liver, or colon failure, and total collapse of the autoimmune system.
Yeah.
Oh, Angela.
Wide variety.
That sounds like a treat for an actor to portray, though. you're going to be in a jail cell screaming and crying and experiencing vaginal
and
wetness.
Orgasming. And
yeah. Yeah. That's like a little bit of everything.
Explosive flatulence. Yeah.
Yeah. There's
I find it interesting that they say don't take it while engaged in intercourse.
Yeah.
Which, with those side effects, yeah, fuck, you don't want any of that.
Mm-mm.
Nah, what if maybe you took, the wetness. Maybe what, the erections.
I was, what if you took a Kevin Garvey nostalgia while you're having sex with someone? Do you go to relive the experience of...
That's what I was thinking, like...
having someone right. raptured right in the middle of coitus. There's also another big warning against weird. Taking another person's nostalgia, yep. as it would erode the boundary between self and other and catalyze hyperactive empathy or extreme fight / flight responses.
So here's where I think that gets interesting, because yeah. We speculated about, is this some, you know, empathy bomb that she's coming up with? And we know now that these nostalgia drugs, when given other people's memories, can cause, like you said, extreme empathy.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a little bit more evidence now
mm-hmm.
for that possibly being true.
But there's also warnings of long-lasting conditions like mania, hypersensitivity, psychosis, schizophrenia, and permanent memory or identity loss. Also, one of the immediate side effects is aphasia, which means loss of the ability to speak. I think that also might be mm-hmm. interesting if, like, Angela has this profound experience but then can't speak. Like, can't tell anybody about it. And, like, uh-huh. wouldn't that be a kick in the ass if, like, you know for a fact what's going to happen, but you can't do anything to prevent it because you can't communicate?
Yeah.
And aphasia is not just the ability to, okay, because then I think someone would email me, be like, well, she just writes stuff down. Aphasia means, like, you lose the ability to process language.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you do speak, it comes out in, like, word salad, if you can speak at all. Like, if you can, like, remember right. how to write your name and things like that. So it's, like, it's not going to be, like, Angela can't speak and she can write shit down. It's, like, she just loses the ability to process language. So yeah. that would be an interesting thing to play with, too.
And I think the idea that, you know, this could cause psychosis or really extreme side effects. The
lasting could ones, either, too.
Yeah, permanently fuck you up or potentially even drive you to kill yourself or kill others. When you kind of pair that up with, you know, Ozzy's plan of dumping this giant squid and killing millions mm-hmm. in order to preserve some kind of peace, you could almost see this empathy bomb as having a collateral effect, collateral damage.
Yeah.
Lady True not giving a shit.
Right.
Because of the greater good in her mind.
And finally, on the PDFiles, there's extra dimensional anxiety in you from a pamphlet or track from 2009. This is the cat staring out the window brochure that Wade was kind of arranging at his meeting for extra dimensional anxiety. I don't think we need to go into, because, like, if you've seen the episode, Looking Glass suffers from it.
Yeah.
Excessive rumination, hyperavoidance, hypervigilance, negative changes in relationship, worldview, paranoia, thrill seeking. The only thing I didn't is suicidal thoughts. Did he talk about being suicidal in this episode?
I don't think so.
But shit, you don't need to have every symptom to suffer from a syndrome. Also, they mentioned that this pamphlet was produced by the Veit Institute for Extra-Dimensional Studies, which has me questioning what role do they play? Like, are they actually trying to help or make it worse? Because, like, having some people traumatized by this event would be seen as perhaps acceptable collateral damage to have the whole world kind of, you know...
Yeah, and there's a section of that brochure that says one of the myths is that it's not as serious as it used to be,
right.
and that people are, you know, getting over the trauma,
mm-hmm.
but in fact they say that's not true. So yeah, you can almost see, like, okay, the Veit giving these people a license to give in to those tendencies, right?
Right. Well, and also in the comic books, the squid only attacked New York City, and there's also something in this brochure that says that this anxiety is increasing in Russia and China. Because there's been an unexplained increase in exotic cephalopodian entity showers since 2001. So maybe it's like Veit saw, it's like, oh, you know, we didn't squid bomb Russia and China, and they're skeptical of this whole thing. So, like, let's crank up the lever on squid showers. Mm. I guess Robert Redford would be doing it at that point. Well, interesting stuff that the PD Files has got.
Yep.
Do you want to see what the email file says for us this week, Jim?
Yeah, let's do it.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of bald maneuvers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Here are the weekly highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Apple TV is releasing a new series based on Blake Crouch's novel Dark Matter. Aaron and I are big fans of his work, so we're picking up the new show on day one. Join us this Wednesday for the preview podcast.
The Shogun Limited series might be over, but that doesn't mean our Shogun coverage has to end. We've got the wrap-up podcast releasing this Tuesday, where we'll consider all your feedback and final thoughts on a series. And because we like the show so much, we decided to go all the way back to 1980 to cover the first TV adaptation of the novel. Do what you can to find a copy and join us this Thursday for the first of our four-part podcast on the 1980 Shogun miniseries.
And finally, the latest first-run movie, The Fall Guy, features Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling. He's a stuntman tasked with finding the star of his ex-girlfriend's movie when he suddenly goes missing. Is it a rom-com? Yes. Does that mean I'll automatically hate it? Not if the trailer lives up to its promise. Join us for the podcast on Bald Move Pulp this Thursday night.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
Okay, we got feedback. You can send feedback in to watchman@baldmove.com, or you can discuss each week's episode on our forums, forums.baldmove.com. Robert emailed us something from last week. He says, I know I cannot be the first to note that Lady True specifically mentions that the Clark Farm is 40 acres during her reveal in episode 4. Emancipated slaves were promised 40 acres and a mule during Reconstruction, and while most did not receive those rewards, most that did were relocated to the Great Plains states like Oklahoma. This cannot be a coincidence. That's a great point, Robert, and I was aware of the whole 40 acres and a mule thing, but like your email kind of sparked me to do some more research, and there's just so much to tear into. I feel like anytime you shine a flashlight in America's dark corners, you turn out a whole bunch of bullshit where we've persecuted black people. But I came across this study by two professors. Where did I write this? Oh, yes. It's called this paper's called The Great Recession and Land and Housing Loss in African-American Communities, Case Studies in Alabama, Florida, Louisiana, and Mississippi by professors Nimherd and Audubar. One of the quotes is, in 1910, black Americans owned just over 15 million acres of land in the United States. That was, I guess, the height of land ownership among black Americans. In 1997, that number had dwindled to 2 million. And they cite in the study, black farmers were disproportionately targeted for eminent domain seizures by racist policies enacted by the USDA to deny black farmers loans. And when all else fails, good old-fashioned fraud and lynchings to strip them of their land rights. And this also led me to a USDA report in 1997 by their own civil rights action team, because they had so much criticism based on their past performance. This is a quote from the report from the USDA itself. There are some who call the USDA the last plantation. An old line department, the USDA was one of the last federal agencies to integrate and perhaps the last to include women and minorities in leadership positions. Considered a stubborn bureaucracy and slow to change, the USDA is also perceived as playing a key role in what some see as a conspiracy to force minority and socially disadvantaged farmers off their land through discriminatory loan practices. So, yeah. like I said, I feel like sometimes people think that I'm just like a bleeding heart liberal about this shit. It's like, up until like 10 years ago, like my opinion is based, like, I don't have anything against black people, but Jesus, historically, why doesn't it seem like they can't get their shit together? And I remember like learning about redlining on there's like a black intellectual, I can't remember which one, on like a Bill Maher's Politically Incorrect, or what's his new show, Real Talk?
Real time.
Yeah. And they mentioned this redlining and blockbusting. And I did like some research on the internet. And I'm like, oh, this sounds like some victim culture mentality shit to me. And I'm like, oh, fuck. Nah. It's like, imagine if you went to research the JFK conspiracy and like every major economist, foreign policy expert, history major was like, yep, nope, that's totally right. The CIA killed JFK. Yeah. That's how my experience has been looking into these like American conspiracies against black people. It's like every single one of them is like, just when you think it's like too crazy, oh, black people had this economic powerhouse in Oklahoma that was generating a whole bunch of and white people bombed them with aircraft. No, it's like I mean
is there anything too crazy? We fucking treated them like property.
Yeah,
there's no thing I wouldn't believe at this point,
right,
that we did to these people,
right? Yeah, and there was this like, you know, brief time during the Reconstruction where maybe they could have done, we could have done something to heal the nation, and the North got bored and took their eye off the ball, and you know, it's been a generation struggle ever since then. So yeah, thanks for bringing that up, Robert. And if you guys want to know more, check out that those studies I cited. I'll try to link them in the show notes. John, who listens to We Do, a Watchmen podcast, at the actual location of a Manhattan phone booth? I do.
I saw this photo.
It's great. He'd send a picture of his laptop sitting on the exact corner. So it's supposed to be downtown Tulsa, but it's Decatur, Georgia. And it's amazing.
Tax incentives are better there.
Yeah. Really? Yeah. It's the
for filming.
It's the Walking Dead stuff. Isn't Decatur, is that where they did the Woodbury shit too?
Oh, I don't know. Decatur sounds familiar.
It does. But maybe it's just because it's a big town in Georgia. But yeah. I like there's like maybe towns in Georgia's like, come on in and use us for a movie set.
Uh-huh.
You know, I would love it. Like, shit. My neighborhood became like a well-known movie set. I think that'd be cool as hell.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the traffic problems are a couple weeks out of the year, but the benefits are watching the Blu-rays and pestering your grandkids for generations to come.
Yeah.
Tara, I have two theories about why the 7K rolled up into Looking Glass's house. One, that he's on their side and they're setting a plan in motion. They're meeting up to discuss further action.
Guns cocked.
Do you think Looking Glass is effectively flipped to the point that he's going to work with the 7 Cavalry in some kind of greater good kind of way?
No, I see this ending differently.
Okay.
I see this as almost like Rorschach in prison moment.
Yeah.
Like from the movie where they're coming into his cell.
Yeah.
Try and fuck him up.
Yeah.
That's what I expect.
Tara continues. Her second theory is they were watching him as a stakeout, and the second he retrieved the alarm system indicating that he has not been set free, they knew he was acting in service of Angela or against them. The other option is that three, they waited until he gave them what they wanted, and now they're going to eliminate him. But Tara continues with her analysis. I believe the character is so morally good since we just got a beautiful and tragic episode exploring his internal self that he'll be acting as a double agent and ultimately thwart 7K's mission. Perhaps he's throwing Angela in jail to literally keep her safe from the catastrophic event being planned. If a funhouse saved him, a prison cell could save her. That's an interesting piece of analysis. I also
We get teleporters in this.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to imagine what couldn't happen now that we have teleporters.
That's true. I also suspect, given this episode, a valiant Rorschachian end for the character who may not live to see that he saved the planet.
I just can't. Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
I also didn't. That's actually an interesting thing that, like, being in a glass house or a fun house might have been the thing that saved him. Because it's like the reflecting kind of angle there.
Maybe. I mean, I was wondering why he survived, but it seems like a lot of people
survived.
There's
clearly some people that survived even out in the blast. There's like one of those JWs wearing the Carhartt, the official JW Carhartt, right, apparently, that was kind of staggered, and a few other people. But Let's move on to Chris's email. I've been meaning to write to you for a couple weeks now. I'm a 36-year-old man from Tulsa, and I've lived here almost 20 years. I only heard about the Tulsa race riots or massacre about 2 years ago. As you can imagine, it's not something that's brought up very often. I feel like I'm having one of those experiences Aaron was having on another show where so many things felt very personal and written just for him. I'm a huge fan of The Watchmen and absolutely adored The Leftovers. I put it into my top five best shows of all time. Mm-hmm. From the fact that it's taking place in Tulsa to the acoustic version of Careless Whisperer, which is by an artist called Alexander Misko, who I found on YouTube a couple years ago around the time I first heard of the riots. I never expected to hear him on anything but a YouTube video. But I wonder, is this show good? So many things feel like they're speaking to me. I feel like I can't see the forest for the trees at this point, but I feel like it's kind of brilliant. This is my experience with the show so far. I've never experienced to be, or never expected to be the next Game of Thrones, but I'm really enjoying it. I mean, that's how I remember thinking about that in The Leftovers too. Like, clearly it wasn't a big audience, wasn't a huge audience. Like, I don't think it ever got more than a million people watching it.
Yeah.
But I didn't give a shit because it's not only the my favorite television show, but I feel like it was made just for me or someone like me. Mm-hmm. So maybe there's only a million people in the whole world that describes, but we really loved it collectively.
I mean, I was questioning, I'm still questioning this. Like, is this show good? But like, yeah.
No, I think the show's good.
It's episodes like this that make me go, yeah, fuck yeah, the show's good. Because of it, just how expertly it's written, regardless, like, it's just constructed well.
And the music?
But it's episodes like the last one where they get really fucking weird constantly, and that's kind of, like, most of what the episode has to offer that I go, is this show good?
I think aesthetically, writing, sonically, everything is A+, and unfortunately, and this is a lot like Game of Thrones, like, I think people are waiting to see the final episode to see whether all this weird shit, as you say, is going to be worth it.
Mm-hmm. It's my only hang up at this point because I think the show is excellent and everything.
Yeah, because we stopped talking about the music, but like I was thinking that like that musical cue when like Wade is sitting there with the remote in his hand, mm-hmm. and you can hear it like this industrial synth just like beating in his skull until just he finally makes a decision. It cuts out. Like, there's just so many smart choices sonically that the show is making.
Yeah.
How many different versions of Careless Whisperer? And like, it always played like at these key moments where he was reliving this traumatic event on multiple levels. It was traumatic personally. It was traumatic, you know, in the cultural and population at large.
Yeah.
But yeah, man, just every once in a while you get one of these things and relax and enjoy the ride. Nate, after I watched episode 5 and listened to your discussion regarding Ozymandias being imprisoned in some strange world he can't escape, it really reminded me of this recentish comic Black Hammer by Jeff Lemire. The main superheroes in this book are similarly trapped in a strange world having difficulty escaping. It wouldn't surprise me at all if Lindelof drew some inspiration from this book. Lindelof himself, being a big comic book fan and even an occasional comic book writer himself, doesn't seem too far-fetched. Did you know that Lindelof had written comic books?
No.
I didn't either. And I didn't bother to verify that fact, but I'm assuming you're shooting straight, Nate. This is a very popular comic. He's referring to Black Hammer. And his level of weirdness is very, very Lindelof. There's smaller connections as well, but this is a big, obvious similarity. Might be worth looking into for where you could take the story. And at the very least, it's a terrific book and worth a read. Also, Legendary Studios recently acquired the rights to Black Hammer. Is this Lindelof's next project? I looked up and there was a synopsis I found that says 10 years ago, Black Hammer and 6 other superheroes had saved Spiral City from the Anti-God, but in process became trapped in Rockwood, a timeless Twilight Zone-ish town. Shortly after heroes arrive, Black Hammer dies. In the present, the 6 heroes live on Black Hammer Farm with very little hope of ever escaping Rockwood.
Hmm.
Fucking weird, man.
Sounds interesting.
Plus, the saving of a city from Anti-God kind of reminds me a little bit of Dr. Manhattan.
Is it going to be better or worse than Under the Dome?
I don't have an opinion on Under the Dome. Was it bad?
Yeah.
Was it?
Right, the first season was pretty good, but yeah.
I remember wanting to check it out because of Agent Hank Schrader and then Dean Norris there, and I never followed through because people weren't talking about it. James has her final email. Dr. Manhattan had difficulty understanding and empathizing with humans because of his changed perspective, so he would probably fail at creating meaningfully intelligent life with purpose and a drive to explore and be curious, because Dr. Manhattan just doesn't have those qualities anymore. Also, all of them are completely identical, so there wouldn't be any kind of race relation issues or arguments amongst them, like copying and pasting the same 2 paragraphs to make an essay. Dr. Manhattan seems to be the only person detached enough from humanity that he sees having small newborns crawl out of a lake and bake under the sun until they reach adulthood is just a fine way to start life. Yeah, it's definitely a Manhattan thing to do, to create this prison with this artificial life. And when is Manhattan going to show up? What's he going to think of this situation? What's this going to be his plot, his part to play?
Yeah, he's still probably the biggest mystery of all of this. Like, is he even going to be in this series beyond the short footage we saw of him?
Yeah, like, is he going to be like literally final moments of this of the season, kind of like a little mystery that you could maybe make a season two on? I don't think that's satisfying. I'm expecting him to show up and be a big part in the final act. I just can't fucking conceive.
I don't. Well, at some point, you get far enough into this series where he's going to almost feel like a Deus Ex Machina, right? Like a literal Deus Ex Machina.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't, man, how are they going to reward that?
I mean, there's ways you can. So I think that we should have a better idea next episode, because there is a natural cliffhanger here with Ozymandias being busted by the game warden and being said that there's going to be no mercy. And like, if Save Me D is either Dan or Doc, we have to see that message being received and something going in motion, because otherwise, like, I don't think Ozymandias can save himself. I don't think he has the ability to get back from Earth with things he can cobble together from a herd of buffalo and tomato trees. I don't think he can get back to Earth. So like, he needs and we need to have that being introduced to the plot, or it will be Deus Ex Machina. So I think next episode we'll have a little bit of answers about what is going on, who Ozymandias' savior is going to be. I mean, even the message itself was a little bit of an annoying cliffhanger. So like, I think we'll get answers on that the next week. We have to have answers to that, because that's got to be what propels the third arc.
You're absolutely right about that.
Yeah. And that's it. If you would like to send us more feedback, please do so at watchmen@baldmove.com. Or again, you can get on the forums and talk with your fellow fans at forums.baldmove.com. We will be back Sunday night after the 9 p.m. airing on HBO to talk about this and our instant take. And if you're a club member, you can join us on Instant Talk and get your questions answered and your early theories aired. That'll be a good time. Check it out on baldmove.com. Until then, I'm your host, Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See you next week.